Welcome to Anchorage Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Anchorage Edition is Michael Carey.
Welcome. Our guests tonight are Paul Jenkins, editor of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, and joining us from Juneau is Greg Erickson of the Alaska Budget Report. Governor Sean Parnell's attempt to roll back the cruise tax hits rough sailing. Paul, the legislature seems reluctant to make changes in the initiative sponsored tax. Tell us about it.
I'm sure it's not because it's an election year and it would look like they're tampering with the citizens. And if you don't, I know that's not the case. I know that would be wrong to even suggest that. What the governor wants to do is roll back that $50 head tax by 25%. He rolls it down to something like $34.50. And he wants to add in then local taxes, local fees, which would actually knock it down to about $19, I think, per head. Also in Parnell's bill, there's a tax credit that lawmakers are kind of shy about because it really does mess with their appropriation power. And to grant that would be lessening their power to tax, if you will. And so they're kind of dragging their feet. And I don't know where it'll go. They're going to have to do something.
And they have time problems.
They have time problems. And the cruise industry has pretty much said, yeah, we'll bring vessels back. There's arguments that the tax is really not the problem and it's a recession. And so I'm not sure which way they'll go. I don't know if they'll do anything this session.
Greg Erickson, how about the latest from the Capitol on the cruise ship tax? What are the parties involved? And there are several parties. What are they saying?
Well, on Tuesday, Senate Finance Committee introduced a new bill. As Paul explained, there's two parts in the governor's bill. That both of them would, taken together, would transfer about $42 million from the state treasury a year to the cruise ship's bottom line. They're about half and half. Half is the tax cut, half is that marketing credit that Paul mentioned. And on Tuesday, Senate Finance introduced a new bill that contains just the tax cut provisions, but none of the marketing credits. And also on Tuesday, Senate Finance Committee co-chair Lyman Hoffman offered a Senate floor amendment to the operating budget, adding $5 million as a marketing grant for the Alaska Tourism Industry Association, which is an industry marketing group. The $5 million is not in the House version of the bill, so that'll be decided by a budget conference committee. I asked Hoffman on Wednesday about the relationship between the new bill and the $5 million, and the substance of what he said is that the marketing credit part of the governor's bill is dead for this year, an assessment that cruise industry lobbyists seem to agree with also. Hoffman said the $5 million is sort of a consolation prize. It'll stay in the budget only if Senate Finance's slimmed-down tax relief bill does not pass. If the cruise industry gets a tax relief, then the Conference Committee on the Budget will axe the $5 million.
Thank you, Greg. Homeless man, or an apparently homeless man, was found dead in a dumpster. Steve, tell us about this story. And is a homeless man found dead somewhere in Anchorage becoming almost a routine story for the Anchorage media?
Well, first of all, about the story, it was a gentleman found in a trash compactor that was attached to the Diamond Mall, and evidently he was seeking shelter there from a cold night, and was caught in the machinery inside this trash compactor. It's the latest in a string of homeless deaths that stretches back to last spring. Last year, summer and spring, we had about a dozen homeless deaths in the Anchorage area. We've seen a couple already in the last few weeks. There was a woman who was found dead on the park strip as well, just before this gentleman with the trash compactor. I hope it's not becoming routine. It's not becoming routine, certainly with us at Channel 2. This is a very serious story. And it's emblematic of several issues that are going on here in town. We've been lucky to escape some of the truly bad side effects of the recession in the lower 48. We've escaped a lot of that, although we are seeing signs of a softening economy up here. They are certainly seeing that at the Brother Francis shelter, and at Beans Cafe, they are seeing people whom they've never seen in those two social service agencies, people who were living paycheck to paycheck, but now because of losing their job or maybe losing out on hours, they are now needing help. That's really stretched the means at those two places to accommodate all the people that need shelter and food, and they're seeing record numbers of people at the shelter. It means a lot of people are now winding up choosing to be out on the street, and it's not really warm just yet. And so there's a lot more to the story than just a person who's died on the streets. It really tells it's endemic of a much larger problem.
I think you did a good job of describing a much more complex and story than especially what happens tragically to one individual.
Right, anytime somebody loses their life.
Okay, let's go back to Greg Erickson. Greg, decoupling. It looks like there may be a bill. Explain to us what decoupling is, why it's important in Juneau, what the basics are, and what you expect to happen.
Well, Mike, after days of, actually 3 weeks of behind-the-scenes work and perhaps behind-the-scenes dithering, the Senate Finance Committee on Wednesday finally produced a bill, and after they talked about it for 24 minutes, they reported the legislation to the floor, and they put it on the floor the next day and passed the bill 19-1, I believe it was, with Senator Con Bundy being the only negative vote. A few senators claim that without this decoupling of the natural gas from the oil, that the state treasury could be plundered after the gas pipeline starts sending gas through Canada. That's probably 10 years away, and the administration and lots of others don't see it as much of a big deal. What's really caused all the excitement is the fear that this bill is a Trojan horse designed to be amended at the last minute in the House to lower oil company taxes. There's some evidence to support that theory, but so far the bill has been kept pretty clean of oil company tax breaks, and a tight title added to the measure at the last minute suggests that if the oil companies are going to get tax relief this session, it's not going to be part of the decoupling bill. So that being the case, it's not clear what will likely happen to the measure in the House. If it can't be used as a vehicle for lowering oil taxes, as a number of House Republicans would like to do, their interest maybe in passing it may diminish.
Greg, can we go back to Chairman Stedman for just a moment? Obviously, he's not going to hold a press conference and say, I have a Trojan horse bill, but what is he saying?
Well, he's stoutly denying that he has any intention to send over a Trojan horse, and he can point to the bill that's going over is really written in a way that won't be a Trojan horse, can't be used that way. But he's persisted in putting oil gas tax breaks in for the producers through four or five versions of the bill as it was repeatedly unveiled and then pulled back into secret discussions throughout the last 3 weeks. So I think there's some evidence that was in the back of his mind, but I think we have to say he's strongly denying that.
Okay, let's go back to Steve McDonald. Steve, President Obama says offshore drilling okay in some parts of Alaska, not okay in others.
Yeah.
He receives applause, including from industry in some cases, and Senator Murkowski and other people are not happy. What's the summary here?
I think he did something that I think all politicians dream of. He's made a lot of people happy and the same people angry, all with one decision. He came in and revised his five-year OCS plan, the Outer Continental Shelf plan. He said that the 2008 lease sale, which Shell paid $2.1 billion for lease holdings in the Chukchi Sea, said it can go ahead, and Shell, providing, of course, that it wins all the permits it needs to win now, can go ahead and drill three exploratory wells out in the Chukchi. At the same time, there have been some challenges to the five-year plan, and he has decided to keep lease sales for Chukchi and Beaufort off the table for the next couple of years at least, so they can do more studies on the environmental impacts exploration wells, oil drilling would possibly have in those areas. But it's good news for Shell. It's been fighting for years now to be able to drill these exploratory wells. So now it's able to go through and go ahead and do these wells, provided, of course, it doesn't have any challenges to the permits, which probably won't happen, right? Yeah, well, it's going to happen.
It's part of the process.
They've got 30 days to challenge this thing, so yeah. So there's going to be an environmental group, perhaps even an Alaska Native village out there that's going to challenge this whole thing, and they'll have to hear the appeal.
Once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Paul Jenkins, Steve McDonald, and Greg Erickson, who's joining us from Juneau. Paul, anything to add on Steve's summary of what the president had to say?
Well, for instance, Congressman Don Young says it's a scam. It's just another way to curtail drilling in Alaska. The senators, our senators, welcomed it with open arms. Yes, this is a great thing. I thought it was instructive that, yes, you can do this if you can get the proper permits from my Interior Department, which is run by a guy who's an environmentalist, and if you don't get sued by environmental interests. And I think Shell, even though it's got $3 billion invested so far, even though it did get its air quality permit it's been waiting for, I think Shell is a long way from punching that first hole.
And that would be true no matter who's president, though,
pretty
right?
much, yes.
Yeah. Okay, thank you, Paul. Paul, let's stick with you. Sarah Palin is back. She's on television with her own show. She's at rallies in the west and southwest of the United States. She's everywhere in the Eastern media, which is putting her on the front page again, or at least the front page of their electronic versions. What's up?
Just gives me the shivers.
I mean, still I don't. Governor?
Who?
Never mind.
I don't think so.
You see her more than when she
I
was
thought
our
she
governor.
Quit. Yeah. No, she's got TV specials. She's got one now. What is it called? Real American Stories, in which she goes out and on Fox News Network, Fox Network, and presents real American stories, wearing a red blazer, looking very, very
American.
And so, before it even aired the first time, there was controversy because Fox had decided they would add in LL Cool J and Toby Keith interviews from a year or two ago, and forgot to tell them that they were going to do it. So that was a big stink. But she did get her first show off, and by all accounts. And, you know, I'm sure there are people who liked it. I don't know who they are.
You TiVo'd it or DVR'd it or whatever you do.
The Washington Post review said basically it was okay.
It was okay. Mediocre, I think, is the word I saw. Sarah Palin's Alaska is also scheduled, eight episodes, in which she'll travel around the state and introduce people to people of Alaska. And who knows how that will go. I'm sure it'll be just a smash.
Aren't we part of
America? Paul, does this make her a candidate for higher office, a rich woman, or both?
Well, she's probably always been a candidate for higher office, but it does make her a rich woman.
Okay, Steve McDonald, one thing we know you know a lot about is television and what makes good television. Is that what this is all about, that the producers of these shows think that they can make winning television that'll draw viewers?
Yeah, that's the name of the game. Yeah, sure. You put on a good show, you get people to watch it, you make some money. So I think that's what they're aiming for here, too. And obviously, hopefully the stories that they're putting out there about these real Americans, I hope those are good and compelling stories, well-told stories. But, yeah, they're also capitalizing on Sarah Palin's popularity right now. She's the hot ticket out there. And so, you know, yeah, so it's a combination of all. Hopefully they're telling some good stories, and they've got a host who's very popular right now. So, and that will translate, hopefully, for them into good ratings, and they'll make some money.
And as we know, television has a need to fill space.
Well, television has a need to fill space with good programming.
Right.
Emphasis.
Okay.
Good.
Let's get back to Greg Erickson in Juneau. Greg, the Parnell Scholarship Program seems to be in trouble. This is kind of a surprise to me. Why is it in trouble, and what can the Parnell administration do to right the ship?
Well, it is in trouble, Mike, and it is a surprise because who's against providing scholarships in a state that has $10 billion in the bank? You'd think we would be able to get together on some sort of program to ensure that higher education is available to to people throughout the state. And so far, that doesn't seem to be happening. The key element of the governor's program is it's entirely merit-based, and it is requires, in order to be eligible for the scholarships, you have to have taken 4 years of language, arts, mathematics, and science, and 3 years of social science. And the fact is, there are a lot of schools in this state that don't provide, high schools that don't provide that. We, in our periodic run-ins with the administration of all stripes and parties over the years, we have one going right now about which schools are would students be eligible or ineligible from. And the Department of Education doesn't want to provide that information because it will make it clear that there are a lot of students, in particularly the rural areas of the state, just aren't going to be eligible for these scholarships because their schools don't provide the courses they have to have. Still, that said, there's no reason why there couldn't be a compromise. Mike Dugan, I think, representative from Anchorage, analyzed it well in a press conference last week. He said that in principle, somebody ought to be able to put together a deal that provides some needs-based scholarships to go in here and perhaps lift some of these requirements for that essentially rule out people from rural schools from getting the merit-based scholars. And you ought to be able to put a deal together that would satisfy everybody at least enough so that it could pass. But Governor doesn't seem to be, or if he is, certainly not evident that he's knocking any heads together or doing the deal-making and arm-twisting necessary to get this to happen. So right now, I'd say it's probably a little less than 50-50 that bill is going to pass, which is a shame, I think.
Are these strictly scholarships, or is there some repayment provision for some, or some cases maybe even all the money?
Under the governor's bill, there's no repayment required.
Okay, thank you. Greg, let's stick with you. While I have you, the House approved a bill to revive Cook Inlet natural gas supplies by an infrastructure by providing incentives so that people will get out there and drill. What have you heard about this, and tell us if there are any problems here.
Well, the bill passed the House this week unanimously, so it's moving over to the Senate. There were two studies this year, recent studies, one by a consulting firm in Anchorage and the other by the Department of Natural Resources, both of which suggest that supplies of Cook Inlet gas are not keeping up with demand. Natural knee-jerk reaction, I guess, of legislators when they hear something like that is to let's provide them with some tax incentives. A little problem with that in the case of Cook Inlet Gas is the Cook Inlet Gas doesn't pay hardly any taxes as it stands right now because legislatures already basically rebated everything to them, or mostly everything. But in order to get around that, the legislation that passed the House basically allows the costs of Cook Inlet drilling to be deducted or made a credit against taxes on North Slope production. The Department of Natural Resources and the Parnell administration opposed that, saying it was, while they wanted to help Cook Inlet, they were concerned that this was a giveaway of state resources to benefit a particular region of the state. But in the House, at least, that argument didn't hold much water, and the bill, as I said, passed unanimously.
Greg, to what extent, finally, is there congruence between the people who are drilling in Cook Inlet and the people who are on the North Slope? Is it the same people?
I don't think it is always the same people, but if this bill becomes law, there'll be more incentives for companies to gain the advantage of doing both. And I think that you'll see that companies that don't have that are active in Cook Inlet that don't have activities on the North Slope will probably sell their interests to companies that do, who can take advantage of the credits.
Okay. Let's get back to Steve McDonald. Steve, we have a municipal election on Tuesday. We've been meeting the candidates here on public broadcasting and also on the commercial station. Does it surprise you that the campaign seems to have been so tame? Last summer we heard all about how it was going to be about the Equal Rights Amendment and people were going to pay and it was going to be intense.
Right. Haven't seen that. Really haven't seen any of that. There's a few things I thought might come up that that groups outside the campaign might have a say in, and that really hasn't happened. It's basically your typical assembly, school board, candidate kind of race, no mayoral race in there, pretty low key. You see programs like the one you hosted here the other night running, and Michael, and then of course the ads and the profiles that are being done on our station and also in the Anchorage Daily News, and it is pretty much just a typical campaign, for the individual assembly races and the citywide school board races, nothing too out of the ordinary.
Paul, might we look for any surprises on Tuesday?
I don't think so. I think money will win, and I think it'll be a low turnout to begin with, which will probably favor the better known of the lot anyway, I would think.
And as the candidates reminded us numerous times last night, the voting has already begun at various stations around the municipality of Anchorage. Paul, the Alaska State Senate says it's time to expand the legislature. Tell us about this proposal, and did it surprise you that it passed?
In a way, it did. This is passed in the Senate. There's another one pending in the House, I guess. The one in the Senate was for 12 seats. The one pending in the House is for 6. I guess it does surprise me. I can't imagine Alaska's won 12 more legislators. But that could be, maybe it's just me.
We should note here, if I might, I don't like to interrupt you, but this has to be voter approved.
This is a constitutional amendment, right. It's got to pass 2/3 of the Senate and the House. Passed the Senate 14-5, so it made it by one vote. What'll happen in the House, anybody's guess. The reason it surprises me that they're toying with, I understand that they want to maintain smaller geographical districts in the rural areas, but it dilutes power. All these guys are going to lose a little bit of power. The more of them there are, the less any one person has the juice. It's going to mean more staff, more expense. It's going to resurrect all kinds of arguments for moving the state capital to Anchorage or to Wasilla. So I'm not sure how we come out ahead on this. The voters, I don't think, would accept it, but we'll have to wait and see. We'll have to see if it gets through the House. But it's not a very popular action right now.
With the public.
The public.
Yeah, we know.
Greg, please explain to us, how did expanding the legislature get legs?
Well, I think there's been some testimony recently by experts, economists, and demographers who have said that the criteria laid down by the Supreme Court under their one-man, one-person, one-vote rule simply cannot be met if we're going to keep the Senate at only 20 seats. We already have a Senate seat that is Al Kukesh's seat, which runs from the southern tip of the panhandle all the way up to the Arctic, and encompasses an area that's larger than Texas. Hugely difficult to represent that area with its wide differences in economic base and demographics and so forth. And really hard to campaign in those areas, too, because it takes tons of money to fly around and meet people. And I too, am surprised. I mean, I think I agree with Paul's assessment in general. And, it is surprising, but I think that testimony has changed some votes. And also, I think that there's one thing you have to admit is that making more seats available makes it less likely that incumbents will have hard-fought opposition because there's more seats for them to run for. It is going to be very interesting to see how this fares in the House. I do think that Senator Gary Stevens, the president of the Senate, surprisingly voted against it. He represents Kodiak in the Alaska Peninsula area, a fairly rural district. And he said he didn't think that it was going to create problems for space in the Capitol. And there is this undercurrent of the effect that it would have on capital move efforts, and that, of course, is of real importance to people in Southeast.
Okay. We need to get Steve McDonald in here briefly, and then we'll go back to you, Greg.
I was just going to add something to what Greg had said, too. Not only is it the sheer size of some of these election districts, but you also had so much growth up in places like the Matsu Valley, where they feel that,
that's
representatives up there are just stretched very thin and haven't been able to keep up with the amount of people moving into the valley, and some parts of Anchorage as well.
The reapportionment is really what's pushing this, and reapportionment is going to shift the center of gravity of Alaska politics much more to the South Central than it already has. And that's a concern to people in Fairbanks and the rural areas around the state.
Greg, we have about 45 or 50 seconds. The legislature is building a capital budget. What can you tell us about the capital budget in this brief period of time?
Well, it doesn't take 45 seconds to say big. We understand that the Senator Stedman, who's got the capital budget in the Senate and has circulated it to other members, at least some other members of the Finance Committee, we haven't seen it yet. There's a pool going on here on our floor to guess how much general fund money will be in that budget. My guess is $830 million, but it's a dart throw, and we'll wait and see.
Okay, and when would we might we see that?
Well, we're hoping to get a copy of that budget on Monday, or maybe even over the weekend. We're kicking the bushes trying to get somebody to show us one.
And we're kicking the door because we're out of here. Thank you very much for joining us. Please come back next week. And remember, if you missed part of the show or want to see the whole thing again, we are on the web. Go to our website and you'll be able to listen to it in part or entirety. Thank you for joining us.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Anchorage Edition at anchorageedition@kakm.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Anchorage Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.